right, welcome back to episode 3 of the Sideline Sessions with Wesley Sykes. I am, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, Training and Conditioning, and Winning Hoops Brands for Great American Media Services. And you can listen to our first few episodes with Aaron Struthers, assistant men's basketball coach for UMass Dartmouth, and NFHS Executive Director, Dr. Carissa Neoff, anywhere you can access podcasts, as well as any of our websites, coachad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com as well. And be sure to follow our brands on Twitter, at coach_AD, at train conditioning, and as well as Winning Hoops, at Winning Hoops. And if you'd like, myself, at Wesley Sykes _. And today we have another very special guest lined up for our show, episode 3 here, as we welcome to the program Jerry Weinstein of the Colorado Rockies organization and manager of the Cape Cod Baseball League's Wareham Gateman. Thanks for joining the show, Jerry.
Good to be here, Wesley.
All right, excellent. And you know, I think it's great that you were able to find some time out here to talk about you know, some of the things that you've done in your career, but you know, where it's a little bit timely with the MLB season just wrapping up and some of the award seasons just kind of getting into play now. Yeah, I would love to hear from someone who's been in the game for as long as you have. Just your thoughts on the MLB season overall throughout this COVID-19 pandemic. A little bit of a rough start, it seemed, but they seemed like everything really kind of came together late in the season for them, and what ended up being an exciting product coming down to Game 6.
Well, I think a lot of credit, A, has to go to the commissioner, because he's the guy that orchestrated this whole process, and he gets a lot of criticism, but I thought that he really excelled in this environment, but also players and coaches and staff and the adjustability that was required for them to pull this thing off was incredible. Lots of sacrifices between players and their families, players and their normal routines and readiness, the stopping and starting play, the uncertainty of rotations, the amount of flexibility that especially starting pitchers had to have when they were ready to, they have their routine, they're ready to pitch, and the game gets canceled or something happens. So I just think everybody, certainly the players and the coaches and trainers, but also the commissioner's office, did an exemplary job in this whole thing. And I thought in the end, it was great. It was like a regular World Series and even better.
Yeah, you know, and I find it interesting, too. I think, you know, a lot was made up, you know, early on in the season when this occurred. I think going back to spring training during the start and stoppage in the season there, and just how much of an impact, whether it's a, you know, a couple weeks time when you're getting ramped up from a season, whether it's from a pitcher's or a positional player's point of view. I mean, how much of a hindrance is that for, you know, an athlete in the sport of baseball, which seems so heavily on routines?
Huge. And I think especially on the pitching side, where those pitchers in spring training 1.0, they ramp up, get ready to for their season, and then all of a sudden they get shut down for 3 months, and then they have a shorter period to get ready. I think that really, I think some of the things that happened during the playoffs and World Series were a reflection of that up and down readiness type process. And then a lot of the COVID rules that were in play really had effect on position players and time at the stadium and what their normal routine would look like. I think that whole process really affected a lot of players, even though most of them, I would say all of them, handled it well in terms of controlling the things that they could control.
Absolutely. And just wrapping up on the 2020 baseball season here, you know, obviously it came down to a decisive decision, you know, in the hands of Kevin Cash for the Tampa Bay Rays there. What are your thoughts on advanced analytics, at least from my point of view, an outsider's perspective, maybe seemingly dictating decisions more and more in the professional game at all? You know, I think of that Blake Snell getting pulled out of the game in Game 6 there. I think it was around 60 pitches or six innings or so. You know, what was your opinion on that? And do you think it was advanced analytics maybe playing a role, or you know, just the overall outset of the 2020 season, as you mentioned, kind of disrupting some things?
Well, I think number one, we never used advanced analytics. You know, it was batting average and on-base percentage and sure, things like that, and slugging. And in the last 5 years, the introduction of advanced analytics helped us quantify the game. Now, I don't think anybody goes. I mean, it's the old statistics thing. You know, they tell you, oh, this, you know, this guy drowned in a river that the average depth was 6 inches. Well, you know, when it's narrow and or shallow, you're going to put your feet in. Where it's deep, you're not. But I think that they use their intuition, and I think that if you really dig deeply, and if I think where the analytic process gets undue criticism was the Snell decision. Number one, nobody knows their team better than the manager.
Sure.
And I think that based on their 60 game season and their process through that 60 game season and past history with Snell based on performance and health, and they were very successful. They won more one run games than anybody in baseball. And how he managed his bullpen was pretty consistent from day one until the end of the season. And I think that a couple of things you have to consider in that decision making. Number one, you certainly have to be able to trust your eyes to a certain extent. Also, mm-hmm. it's not all data. And I think that that Kevin Cash did that as well, but maybe relied on data a little bit more. But also, he is probably he's a real players manager, and he really trusts his players. And and especially when guys are going bad. I think we saw that with some of the guys that were really scuffling, and he keeps throwing them in there in the lineup. And I think that was the case with Anderson. Anderson was not the same guy in the playoffs as he was during the season. During the season, mm-hmm. he had an 0.55 ERA with an unbelievably low WHIP, but he had hit some rough patches during the playoffs and given a number of runs up during the season. Wasn't the same guy, but Cash trusts his players, and he believes in their ability to bounce back, and so he gave Anderson the ball. I think the reality was that maybe the communication wasn't as good as it should be based on how Anderson really felt and the transparency between Anderson and the pitching coach or the bullpen coach or the manager. And I think if he would change anything, is not necessarily taking Snell out, but maybe going to a different pitcher in that situation. But there's a couple things that happened during the season that really made for that decision. Number one, the ramp up. So you don't have pitchers mm-hmm. that are built up. You know, they're going to, in spring training, normally they'll go maybe two or three innings, and the next time they'll go four, another four, and then maybe a five, and another five, and then a six, and then maybe a seven. Well, that never happened. So they never had the foundation to develop high pitch counts. And so that's number one. Number two, they had 28-man rosters. And the 28-man rosters meant teams were carrying a lot more pitchers, some teams as many as 15 pitchers. So when you have 15 pitchers, you don't just guys just don't vegetate down there. You get them into games, and they got used to using a lot more relief pitchers than they normally would. And so they relied on those guys. And plus, they were the best team in the American League. They had a tremendous record. They had a lot of success doing that, using their staff. And you can't expect a guy to be effective if he only gets out there every couple weeks or when you need him in a blowout one way or another. And then the second thing was, the next thing would be that there was never a situation during the year where a starting pitcher had to be extended because the bullpen was toast. Like, hey, we don't have much pen tonight. We got to extend you a little bit tonight. Mm-hmm. That never happened. A, because they had 15 pitchers down there. B, because the guys never had that foundation. So during that 60 game season, that never happened. Now that happens frequently during the season where you have extra inning games or where you go through your pitching staff or a lot of close games where you got to use a lot of your back end guys. And so what happened is that pitcher was never put in that situation. And based on his past history, there's a great article in The Athletic. Eno Saris wrote it. I don't know if you read it. I think it mm-hmm. is really meaningful, and I think it really hits on a lot of the points that I've alluded to. But I think that all those things weighed in on that decision. And I think if he had to do it over again, he'd make the same decision. Maybe not go to Anderson in that situation. Maybe go to Diaz or someone else in that situation. Maybe not. I don't know.
I love it. I love getting inside the mind of kind of the chess match and every and all the working pieces of a coach who actually knows the inner workings of what goes on a day to day in a professional ball club. So I really enjoyed that answer, and I would agree that there is kind of probably a fine balance right between the use of the advanced analytics and statistics to help better make better decisions, but also kind of relying on the gut and the feel of the game to a certain degree as well. Do you see that role of advanced analytics kind of having that trickle down effect at all to maybe high school and the college game more so? I'm thinking of maybe, for hitters as far as like approaching things with a launch angle or, spin rate in pitchers. Do you see that becoming more buzzwords in the high school and college ranks?
No doubt, especially colleges. I mean, the colleges are more tech savvy than a lot of the pro teams. Matter of fact, a lot of the administrators that are handling those data programs in professional baseball cut their teeth in college baseball. And I think that there's so much information out there, and the young players are so tech savvy that's right in their wheelhouse. They're used to spending time on the internet and doing research and things like that. And just about, I mean, there are numerous academies in every town. Kids are getting on Rapsodo or TrackMan or some type of analysis, hitters on Blast and Diamond Kinetics. And so all those things are on the forefront, and they're tailoring their training, pitch design or velocity development or bat speed or bat quickness or launch angle or attack angle based on a lot of the metrics that they're getting at a lot of these academies and a lot of the high schools as well.
So, I think of this, I play, I try to play as much as I can, golf a lot. And when I'm a decent player, but when I step onto the course, I kind of go, try to play off feel. I try not to do too many practice swings. I just try to have a couple of things that I like to work on here and there, with the thought being that if I add too much into my head, then this fine house of cards that is my golf game suddenly comes crashing down because I'm thinking too much. Is that at all transferable to the game of baseball at all, and especially in higher levels or maybe lower levels, as we're just discussing with the college and high school game?
Yeah, no doubt, at every level. The mind is an unbelievable thing. The mind, this game may be 95% physical, but the 5% mental controls the 95% physical. And so I think that's one of where coaches and trainers come into play there, is you're more or less a guardrail for the player relative to data, where they don't get overblown with trying to be perfect players and their data, and more external focus than internal focus. And, if you're into mechanics and you're into, especially in the batter's box, you have no chance to react to a 90 plus mile an hour fastball, or if you're thinking about where your body parts are, you have no chance to execute pitches. It's got to be instinctive. And so the training, and now certainly the design of the training, drills and things such as that to pull off a particular movement pattern through a drill with an external focus and not worrying about body parts necessarily in the finite mechanics, and getting too granular in the process can certainly vapor lock, analysis by paralysis. And, basically it's see it and hit it and create, we try and have, for instance, if you take a hitter, I try and put him in a drill environment with a particular goal, and the focus is on ball flight, because that's what we're interested in. A particular ball flight for each individual player. If it's an Adam Dunn type guy, it's a high line drive, high fly ball profile. If it's a Juan Pierre, it's a line drive to hard ground ball profile. So what we ask them to do is just organize their body in a way that they can produce a particular ball flight, whether throwing or hitting. And then it's almost like we backward chain it. And, we have a swing or a pitch, and we like the profile of that pitch in terms of spin axis or spin rate or velocity, and then we look at the mechanics that produce that. And there's a lot of variability. They can produce those data points with a lot of different movement patterns. It's not just only one that produces it. There's a there's a wide bandwidth relative to movements that produce particular outcomes. So it's not just one thing. So you got to be able to make adjustments and do things, particular things with different movement patterns.
Yeah, I find this so funny because from a reporter's perspective, there's been so often where I've been, you know, talking to hitters after a game who've just had a game-winning hit or, you know, a big moment coming up at a big spot at the plate. And I'll ask them to take me through, you know, what would you see on that pitch? What were you looking for? What was kind of going through your mind? And I'm expecting an answer kind of similar to what you gave me in some sense of ways, going, you know, kind of getting into the details as a reporter. That's what I would want. And so often I'll get this phrase that you had mentioned in your answer there is see the ball, hit the ball. And I'm like, well, I can't really work with that too much, but I can appreciate, you know, that sense of clarity or clear-mindedness in those big moments when the pressure's on and just kind of simplifying things to a degree.
Well, I think when something good happens, especially with a hitter, they'll tell you they're seeing the ball well and they're on time. And those two things are interconnected. Seeing the ball well and being on time are two critical aspects. And I think that's probably the, in a certain sense, the black hole in hitting is the vision piece. You know, the gaze strategy, where are your eyes? And certainly the mindset too, where you can just trust what you're seeing and then react to it. Because if you throw out a bad swing, but you're on time, you've got a chance. You throw out an A-plus swing, but you're not on time. If you're early or late, you're probably going to be in trouble.
You know, we'll shift gears to the catcher position, which is one I believe is a little near and dear to your heart here. If your Twitter handle is any evidence, of course, if you'd like to follow Jerry on Twitter, you can follow him at J1Catching, right? That's W-O-N, not O-N-E, J1Catching there. But what I love about, you know, following you on Twitter there is much like Max Friedman, the pitching ninja, who breaks down these great videos of pitchers and all the swords and everything that he gets up there. I really enjoy some of the nuance that you've been breaking down about, you know, catchers and how they block things on the plate or how they go and pick a runner off or even when you have a setup on a double steal, I think I saw recently between first and third on a situation and some sort of a set play with the shortstop cutting off the throw and going straight to home there. You know, that small game, those small details is something that I think people kind of forget about in the game of baseball a little bit. But I think that's what makes the game so great is those small little chess-like moves that can make a big difference in a play, whether you execute it offensively or thwart it defensively there. But from a catcher's point of view, can you know, maybe describe the perfect way to approach a play at the plate situation or, you know, how the best way to get a runner out in that, again, that first and third situation that you had kind of broke down on your Twitter account?
Yeah. First it's JW on catching.
Oh, okay. I like that. Okay. It's funny where the emphasis that makes more sense to be honest.
Anyway, let's go tag plays first. And the game has changed since Cousins ran over Posey and did major damage to his leg and the collision play at home plate. And so now base runners have to slide straight into the plate. They can't go through the catcher unless the catcher happens to be in the line. And if the catcher's in the line, the catcher can be in the line with the ball or moving to catch the ball, and then he's fair game in those situations. What we talk about, it used to be where you'd set up with your left foot on a throw from left field or center field. We set up with our left foot on the third baseline and then make the play. Now we set up about, and I use a plate to measure it. I go 17 inches inside the line and 17 inches in front of the plate. And the reason we set up in front of the plate, and professional baseball is a little bit different because we have instant replay. And so this, you know, a lot of times if you set up at the plate and just in front of it, whether you're inside the line or on the line, when the runner gets there, every play is going to be a close play. It's going to be a bang, bang play. That's number one. So we move about a little, almost a foot and a half up towards third base and a foot and a half inside the line. And the base runner has a whole plate to slide to. And we know if we do that, we know where he's going. He's going straight into the plate or maybe slide by and reach back. The other thing that has happened in baseball with the one-break gloves, which have been around for a long time, probably since Johnny Bench, but you can catch the ball one-handed. So a lot of the tags now are one-hand sweep tags, and we encourage that. Now, if I get the ball real early and I catch the ball and I secure it with my bare hand, keep a little distance between my glove and the hand, and I make that tag from the side. And again, by being inside and making the tag from the side, you're getting the ball a little bit early. You can you're not taking the full brunt of the slide, the impact of the slide straight into you, because you're on the side. So now I'm on the side, I'm making that sweep tag somewhere maybe on the foreleg or even on the hip, but I'm catching them before they get to the plate. So it's a one-hand sweep tag, and as I make that tag, I kind of pivot, follow my glove, and look for a secondary runner. Now, if it's going to be a really close play, as I'm making that tag, like it's going to be, they're just getting there when the ball's getting there, or they're just getting there, the ball gets there just before. Now I'm going to two knees, and I'm pivoting. This is hard to visualize, but I'm driving both knees, and I'm making kind of a full circle on my knees where I'm driving that runner off the baseline. It's almost like the tide has turned. You know, now we're, to a certain extent, punishing that runner legally, like they used to punish us when we were in the baseline just getting the ball or without the ball. And so now I make that two-knee pivot tag, I call it, with both knees pointed in the same direction, both feet pointed in the same direction. So now if I get hit, I'm not resisting it with my toes behind my knees and going straight back, putting a lot of pressure on tendons and ligaments. Now, right field is a little bit different from right field. And this is, again, I'm probably an outlier in this sense, but in right field, if I set up 17 inches in front of the plate and inside, and the throw is on the foul side of the home plate, on the first base side foul, when I have to reach for that ball, that takes my body away from home plate and I lose the play. So from right field, I set up behind the plate on the corner. So it's kind of 17 inches still away from the foul line, but I'm behind the plate. As I catch the ball, if it's a bad throw, I'm still able to move toward the runner. I'm not moving away. If it's a good throw, I've got 250 odd feet to react to it. Now I can just move up inside the line 17 and 17 and make the play. When I'm up in front of the plate, 17 inches, and let's say the throw throw from center field, and I'm going to get an in-between hop, okay, I can take a drop step. So I take a step back with my left foot and create a longer hop, and the plate's still right in front of me, and I can make the tag. If I'm on top of the plate and I take that drop step, now I have to reach back to the plate to make the tag. So it gives me more opportunities to be in a position to make tags. I make the tag, one-hand sweep. I follow my glove. I get the ball up out of the glove so the umpire sees I have control of the ball, but I'm also making that subliminal out sign. And if it's a bang bang play and they have to go to review, it has to be clearly safe. And so now when he's called out because of my tag and the strong suggestion I made, it has to be proven without a doubt that the guy is safe. So that's kind of in a
The power of the mind there, right? It's the same thing like a runner running down to first base, bang, bang, play. He throws the hands out as he's crossing first base there, right? It's it kind of put it in the mind of the umpire. Well, I like that.
It works sometimes. Some umpires don't like that. You know, they'll give you, hey, let me umpire. That's what I get paid for. But,
sure.
You know, again, you communicate, but in general, you're making a subliminal suggestion. The other question you asked me about, first and third.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And then that cutoff play there between whether it's a shortstop or a second baseman, depending on the call there, right? It's going home as opposed to
that was a little different play. It was JPB, Japanese professional baseball game this year. And there was a left-hand hitter up there, and I think it was two outs. And the catcher came up and froze the runner at third base by looking at him. In the United States, we don't do that. We just throw without looking, and we're either going to get the runner out at first base, he's the priority because we don't think the guy at third is running or he's not important, or there's a read in the middle of the diamond. But he happened to look him back, and I kind of like that if it's the right situation. If you've got a less than blue chip base runner at first base, and I've got time to look him, because looking back slows you down. But in looking back, I'm looking for one of two things. I'm looking for the third baseman to raise his glove in the air, which tells me that guy's too far off the base and we can pick him. So then I can go straight to third or even arm fake and then go to third. Or I look at the base runner as well. I don't like what I see. I'm going to arm fake and go to third. If I don't see one of those two things, I throw to second base. In the case of that play, the second baseman predetermined that he was going to cut that ball. There was no read there. He was just too aggressive. He came up aggressively, got the ball on the grass, and threw the guy out easily at home plate. And then the catcher made gave with the tag and was out by a lot. And so that's one way of defending the first and third play. In the United States, we just go no look and throw him out. And there's the shortstop or second baseman will make a read, or he might get some verbal help from the off infielder or even the third baseman, possibly, depending upon how loud it is in the stadium. And then, or we don't care about the runner on third base. Let's say we got a 4-run lead in the eighth inning and there's two outs and we're just going to throw that guy out at second base. And then if you're really concerned about that guy, maybe it's an arm fake or maybe it's a straight throw to third base or even a straight throw to the shortstop coming straight up on the grass, because to the runner at third base, it looks like you're throwing straight through to second. A lot of possibilities there.
You know, I find it very interesting in saying the differences in approaches between, the Japanese game and the American game there. And as someone who's, has seen as many players over the country, over the world as you have, is there, can you tell a player from a certain region based off their style of play, whether it's in the country or, I think of, the Japanese players are a great example, whether they're hitters, I always feel like they have their hands high and up at the batter's box. And, pitchers are so often to have that hitch in their delivery. But when in a style of play, can you tell players from Northern California, from Southern Florida, or?
I think within the United States, you can't. There's so many good coaches all over the country today. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's one style. I think it used to be West Coast small ball guys would bunt and this and that and the other thing. And so if you saw a team play, you would see a scheme that would be a little bit different than maybe a Midwest or Northeast team. Or it depends. It depends on the coach and what his resume is, where he's been and what he's done. I think that everybody tries to tailor their play to the capabilities of their players. You can't force a style of play. You can't have a bunch of guys 6'4", 260 and – hey, we're going to bunt a lot and we're going to run a lot. Hey, that ain't happening. They're trying to get the ball airborne and go bridge as much as they can. But as far as seeing a player play and say, oh, he's from Florida because of the way he plays, or he's from California because of the way he plays, I don't think in today's game you can differentiate. Now, if you saw a player from Japan or Korea or Taiwan, they have a pretty distinctive style, hitting style. And there's a lot of similarities in a lot of their hitters, a lot of leg kicks, a lot of mm-hmm. hands away from their body, a lot of bat tilt. Pitchers, there's a lot of hesitation in their delivery, start and stop. You see a lot more splitters from their pitchers, mm-hmm. lesser velocity for the most part, even though, there's Darvish-type guys. But less of velocity-type guys and more pitchability. It used to be that, and I think it's still the case, that they probably have players with more diverse skill sets relative to hit and run and slash or short game skills. Our game is now become a lot more of a power game with less diverse skill sets for a lot of our players, which to me is too bad. I'd like to see guys that could. I want to line up with nine number three hitters that can move runners, that can drive the ball, can execute, can hit a ground ball with a runner on third base and the infield back with the game on the line, or those types of things. And we're not seeing as much of that in today's game. I think that that's a product of what the metrics of the game are telling us, mm-hmm. that slug is really important and, weighted on base percentage plus. So extra bases are really important. And so from a data standpoint, but again, you've got it's a very even though it's a data-driven game, it's also a situational-driven game, and it's based on personnel. Their pitcher, your hitter, the scoreboard, the outs. Is it windy? Is it wet? Is it, are the lights, you know, are you hitting with shadows? Are you, is it twilight and it's hard to see? Is it, you got a guy that does this, this, and this, but he's got a bad thumb, so he can't do some of that, or you got a pitcher out there who's got impeccable command, but not today, or he's one-sided and controls one side of the plate, or one, he doesn't get his breaking ball over, you know, so you have to adjust to the moment. It's a pitch by pitch game in that sense. And hopefully as a manager, you have a player that has a diverse enough skill set that he can take advantage of some of the opportunities that are presented to him. Big shift, you know, we're down a run and you're a leadoff hitter in an inning and they're playing a shift on you as a left-hand hitter. And, you know, and he doesn't have that short game base hit bunt to third base skill.
I would love to see that more and more often as someone, as a Red Sox fan growing up. You know, I remember seeing that shift enforced heavily on David Ortiz for so long. And so often he would, you know, hit a rocket shot to, I guess, the second baseman who was in what shallow right field at that point, would taking away, you know, a clear single, maybe a double, depending on the trajectory of the ball. I would love to see, again, I think this is something else that you had highlighted on your Twitter page. Yeah. I think it was Kevin Biggio with the pop-up double, you know, down the third baseline or shallow left field against the shift. And some things like that, you know, I think you miss kind of those situational opportunities, as you mentioned, in the game today.
Well, since you mentioned the Red Sox, I looked at base hit bunts in the big leagues from 2008 to 2020. And the batting average on bunted balls, and these, I'm sure some of these were sacrifices as well, bunted balls that were bunted in fair territory. And keep in mind that if it's a sacrifice bunt, it doesn't factor into this, the where you advance the runner. So right, whether they base hit bunt or it's a straight sack, it doesn't come into play. But the batting average in the big leagues was .398.
No kidding.
Fewest number of base hit bunts in that period was the Red Sox, 113. And the most was the Minnesota Twins at 313.
Yeah, you know, you didn't have to tell me those numbers for me to have an idea that the Red Sox never bunt at all. I've seen enough games for them where that's frustrating. Although I did think they got back to a little more small ball under Alex Cora, and I think that showed a little bit. A little crazy on the base running, but, you know, I think they were among the league leaders in steals that year. They won the World Series in 2018, so... But yeah, not surprising that the Red Sox don't bunt or get the ball in play on bunting that often. Doing a little bit of research, like I said, Anya, I came across a stat that you've sent, 213 players getting drafted throughout your career and 28 of them getting the call up to the show. So, you know, I think a question from someone as a player development standpoint, you know, how do you approach getting college players, newly drafted professionals, you know, ready to make that step up into the show?
Yeah, well, those stats were from Sacramento City College. I think, you know, I've been with the Rockies for the last 13 years. So, you know, I'm going to speak from, I think from a professional or an amateur situation. The first thing is you got to know your players before you start to dig in and change people immediately and start doing stuff. And so you have to give, you know, for instance, in professional baseball, all these guys were the best of the best. They were the best player on their team or the best player in their league. And their security blanket is their routines and how they play and how they swing and how they throw. And I think that you have to be very careful. And I know we are in terms of making changes with players too soon, because that erodes their confidence. You mean, I can't do this. This is what I do that made me successful. And confidence is everything. That's the most important trait that in anything that you do. If you're confident, you got a chance. If you have doubt, you got problems. And so everything that we do, we want to be sure, even though it's not an exact science when we start doing things, you know, we're hopeful that certain things can work, but, learning of players, and then also having a relationship. And the first thing you do in the relationship and say, hey, you can't do this here. Wait a minute. What do you mean? That's what I do. Now I can't do that. So, you know, before we, and you've only seen me you only see me play catch, or you've only seen me on videos. And so you have to be careful about making changes, but also you have to develop a relationship with the player so that, and also you have to indicate the fact that you're fallible and you've made a lot of mistakes, and this is, we're collaborating on this. This is your career. Ultimately, it's the decisions that you make. And so we're going to look at some things that we think can help you become better, but we want you to be part of a big part of the process. You know, I always tell players, I'm not here to be your coach for the rest of your life. My job is to eliminate my job. My job is here. I'm here to help you coach yourself. And the best lessons are self, and most long-lasting lessons are self-taught. So in that respect, you know, that becomes really important. And those things can't happen unless you're transparent and honest with the player. And you better have good data. And you better also be understood that, hey, this may work and it may not work. We don't know. Sometimes you know, it's a spray gun operation that we hope some of it sticks, and you know, we've got to really be intelligent about how we do it. And having the data, it really helps us, because it verifies, you know, and they're data driven people. And so when you take, look at, you're a catcher in the big leagues, and of all the catchers, and if we're working on throwing, let's say, of all the catchers in the big leagues, there isn't one catcher in the big leagues that has a release as slow as yours is. So what do you think? Do you think this is something that we should work on? You know, and ultimately, when you have that relationship and they see that, and then that they're not having success throwing people out. Now, that doesn't mean if you have a slow release that you can't throw people out. If you're throwing the ball 90 plus miles an hour and you're accurate, you can make up for certain release deficiencies. But those, you know, that's just an example of
sure
what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I think it's great. And then getting back to or turn to a subject that's kind of near and dear to my heart with the Cape Cod Baseball League. Growing up, going to the league as a kid, born Braves games and everything. You know, that with such a shortened season with the Cape League, 44 games. You know, you have these players for such a short amount of time. You know, how do you? In some cases, I'm sure they're coming back for a second year or some sort, something along those lines. But you know, how do you get through to them and create that relationship in such a truncated period of time, as opposed to a minor league season, for example, or spring training?
Well, it's a difficult environment because it's become somewhat of a showcase league, and I'm not a showcase coach, and I'm a player development coach, and so I try and get the players that are there to get better. Certainly we want them to be able to go to their strengths and showcase what they can do, but also we want them to be able to, we have two goals at the end of the summer. We want to send them back to their college healthy, and we want to send them back as a better player. And we try and develop a relationship before they come, even though that's difficult because they're really committed to their colleges and spending all the time
sure.
their priority is. We try and get the our development is a big piece of the puzzle here. Whether we win some games or lose is not a primary goal of ours. Now, certainly we don't want to go out and lose every night. We're trying, when we have opportunities, we want to win. But more importantly, we want to develop the players and develop the players the best way. And you, as you stated, it is a truncated season. You have very little time. And so that's a challenge. It's a coaching challenge. Because when you're working on development, it's not a linear path to the moon. You often have to get worse to get better. You have to lose to win, and we try and talk about the end of the tunnel, not the tunnel itself. You know, where do you want to be? You want to be a Cape All-Star, or you want to play in the big leagues? Not that those two are mutually exclusive, because a lot of those Cape All-Stars
sure.
are big players. And that's the thing about the Cape. The skill level is so great. But, adversity is a great teacher, and nobody likes to look bad or fail, but sometimes it's necessary to develop properly. If you, you're in Lancaster and you throw 100 miles an hour and get everybody out, but you don't have a secondary pitch, or you can't throw your changeup for strikes, or you haven't developed a breaking ball, how is that helping you get to the big leagues? How is that helping you? Making you a better player for the Rockies, where we're going to win in the big leagues? You know, it's all about winning in the big leagues. And again, with the players, the individual players, it's all about them getting to the big leagues, help their team win, and be in a position to stay there and not just get there. And so it's challenging, and it's not easy.
You know, I think when you said that it's kind of the Cape League's kind of turned more into a showcase league, I think one of the things, at least in my opinion, that maybe would lend to that thought is the proximity of all the teams, right? And how much appealing that is to major league scouts. So the theory that all 14 or all 10 teams are within an hour of each other, and in theory you can go see a starter in Bourne and then travel down to Kootenai and see a middle reliever or a couple hitters, and then end your day in Hyannis and see a closer there from a scout perspective. I think that is very appealing. And then the whole process kind of wields around Major League Baseball in that sense, right? They're going to cater to the scouts because they want the players to get noticed there. But, I look to some players. I think Alec Baum is a great example. If I'm just going back and looking at his time in the Cape League, the numbers I don't think necessarily bear out as like maybe jump out to me as a number one overall pick if I'm just following from the Cape League. But now you look now, I think he's one of the finalists for Rookie of the Year this year. So when numbers don't bear out, what do you look for, or what do you think scouts look for in a player that it says this can be a guy, even though it didn't necessarily work this summer on the Cape?
Well, it's not about performance. Otherwise, it's not like, oh, a guy performs in the Cape, he can go right to the big leagues. That ain't happening. It's about projection. You like to look at, and it's a short season, so you like to be able to project and look at the physical tools and what are the skills going to look like in 5 years or 6 years. It's not about performance today. It's about performance in the future. And scouting is really hard. It's the most important job in baseball, and it's really difficult because the biggest piece of that puzzle is anybody can scout. This guy's going to hit, and this guy's going to have power. Maybe power's maybe sometimes a little bit more difficult because sometimes power comes late. But there's no mistaking a guy's got a great arm because you got the radar gun, and you can see if it's a great breaking ball, and you can put numbers on it and quantify, and you can get running speed and all that. That's not what the great scouts are able to do. What they're able to do is they have a vision. They have a file cabinet of players that this guy reminds me of this player, and this is how he projected, and this is how he played here, and this is what he became. And then just knowing makeup. Makeup is huge. Makeup is huge. Sometimes, you'll see players, and they're really good when they're the best guy. And then all of a sudden, when they get out there with guys that are just as good as they are or better, how do they perform? And that's one of the values of the Cape League. It's a pretty level playing field. Everybody's got good players. They're all good. Everybody's got big-time pitching arms and pitchability and guys who can hit. And now, as opposed to maybe in the college where there's a wider standard deviation in the ability of the players, now you're seeing a fairly level playing field. And again, close proximity, and it's playing 40 plus games in 40 days, and so it's very attractive to the scouts for all those reasons.
And you mentioned it's pretty even playing ground across the Cape here. I think as a writer, again, maybe almost to a fault, I go into this idea of romanticizing different topics, right? And I have this idea of this all the Cape League managers kind of get together at a local bar at the end of the night, have a few whiskeys and cigars, and everyone kind of knows each other's tricks and everything. Is that the case? Do you know when you're facing a Mike Roberts, if he walks a leadoff batter, he's probably pulling the pitcher early on, or some of the small games of Scott Pickler or other things like that? Is that gamesmanship with the familiarity with one of all of the managers there? Is that in play more?
I would say that's very minor. I think basically most of the guys take care of their own team. They're more concerned with their own team and what they ask their players to do. And I haven't had a cigar or a drink in the Cape in 3 or 4 years I've been up there. So that's not a factor for me. I don't think for most guys, they're just about, hey, helping the player. Great guys in the Cape coaching players, and they're all about the players. And I think for the most part that's why it's a good league, because it's a player league, and And most of the guys are there for the, I would say everybody's there for the right reason, to make sure the players have a positive experience and get the information that they need to help them achieve their goals.
Okay, so it's just a writer thing, me romanticizing something. I got it. That's fair. we got last question here as we wrap up. And again, I'm very appreciative of your time here, but we touched on this a little bit in regards to the start of the 2020 Major League Baseball season. But how do you think the disruption routines, training sessions, maybe abbreviated seasons, you know, from the trickle down level of, you know, high school to college and so on, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, what effect do you think that'll have on player development in the coming years?
Well, I think the one thing that, based on the 60-man roster and the taxi squad and a lot of guys getting to the big leagues that would normally not get to the big leagues, maybe for 2 or 3 years. And I think that there's a progression. And I think that with contraction in professional baseball, we'll be moving players faster because there'll be fewer leagues. But I think that one of the things that we found this year, or to a certain extent, that a guy didn't have to go to short season A or a rookie league, short season A, then low A, then high A, then double A, then triple A. There were guys who were performing well that had A-league experience, that the normal that we can move players faster and get younger players to the big leagues, have a longer shelf life with those guys because they don't get arbitration eligible as soon, and then and they're more cost effective. And so I think that moving players differently will be one of the things that is a byproduct of the COVID-19. But also, you know, I think players, even though they didn't like it, I think that one of the biggest thing that hurt a lot of hitters is they didn't have access to the video room. They didn't have, guys didn't have as much time at the field because there were restrictions on how much time you get to the ballpark. So in that sense, they had to develop new routines. And I think that overall that players will have benefited by that experience because as difficult as it was, I think that they have confidence in the fact that, hey, I can get through just about anything if I can get through this.
All right. That's great. And I, again, appreciate you taking the time out here. Before I let you go, this is something I like to do with all our guests here, which is a quick lightning round question that I like to do with all the guests. It's called 5 questions that have nothing to do with sports. So I'll ask you a couple questions and then kind of rapid fire, whatever comes to mind, that'll be your answer there. Does that sound fair?
Well, I'll let you know after I answer the questions.
Fair. I like that. That's a great answer there. Okay. First question, number one, if not working in baseball, what would you have done in your career?
I think I might have been a football coach, or I might have gone to law school. I'm not sure. One of those two.
Okay. Like so if not a baseball player, your football was a secondary sport for you growing up?
Yeah, you bet.
Was your position?
I was a center, and I play, you know, a single wing. So you had to snap the ball and I had coach. I like coaching football. I did in high school and a little bit in the community college. So I like football.
Okay. So you said you didn't enjoy many, cigars or whiskeys out in the Cape. But what was your favorite, you know, free time? You have a day off. You have an afternoon off on the Cape. Where would you like to go? Is there a restaurant, a beach, a location of yours that you enjoyed the most?
I like to go to the gym and work out. That's what I have my routine. Even here now, we live in a coastal community in California, my wife and I go to the beach in the morning and drink our coffee, read the newspaper. Then I go to the gym, and then in the afternoon, there are a couple colleges in the area that are working out. I go out there and then do stuff like this at night, or write or read or whatever. So that's I got a pretty vanilla life. Well, we do go out to eat, though. I like, and we have a house right on, kind of on the water, across from the bay, in Wareham.
Oh, excellent! So you'd frequent the YMCA in Wareham. There is that where you go to when you're down there?
I go to Planet.
Planet Fitness. Oh, yeah, I was just there earlier today, actually. So that's great. $10 down, right?
That's my go-to.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. All right. Well, I know you said it sounds like you're a big, you know, workout, you know, advocate here, but Halloween just wrapped up. Is there, what's your favorite Halloween candy?
I don't eat any candy. Well, actually, anything chocolate, especially dark chocolate, but I'm trying not to eat a lot of candy.
Okay, so another food-related question here as we get to the fourth one. Thanksgiving, yeah, we said goodbye to Halloween. We're saying hello to Thanksgiving here. Do you have a favorite side during Thanksgiving?
Ooh, I like the stuffing.
Now, are you a box guy? Or does someone have a, you know, family recipe that they kind of throw together there, or just go with a plain old stovetop that works, right?
Well, it depends on where we go. If it's a family thing, and which probably won't be this year because of COVID, but my wife is really a good cook, so whatever she makes is what I like.
That's a great answer, right? That's probably why you've been together for so long.
Especially if she gets to hear this interview.
Yeah, make sure we get that on the record there. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. And our last question here, what is your dream car? Are you a car enthusiast or car enthusiast at all? Excuse me.
I'm not. I'm not. It just anything that gets me from A to B. I had a 64. My first car I got when I was a senior in college was a 63 or 64 Volkswagen. And I had it for like 15 years. No, I'm not a car guy. However, I do really like to watch a lot of those car shows. I like Counts Custom and stuff like that, or Fast and Loud, the Gas Monkeys. I do like to look at the cars, and I go to car shows and especially the ones where they have antique type cars. I like it, but not to drive, just to look at. They're worth the park for me.
Yeah, I'm an automatic guy. You know, I would love to be able to say I know how to drive a stick shift or change my own oil or do all that stuff. I can change a tire, but that's about it when it comes to cars. So I would love to be like a little more savvier around cars there. So that's something when I finally grow up, maybe I'll pick that up as a hobby.
Yeah, well, that's not in my cylinder. I work out, I read, I write, and I do baseball, and that's pretty boring. That's about it.
That's a pretty full day. You know, I like that. That's a good day if you ask me there. So that's it. You survived five questions that have nothing to do with sports. Pretty painless, right? That's good.
Yeah,
that's good,
not time. Bad. Yeah, I'm good. Good series of questions.
All right. Excellent. Well, Jared, thank you very much again for taking the time out to speak with us, and best of luck, you know, the rest of the off season here. And we hope, you know, you have a great holiday season and the start of the new year. You know, you can follow Jerry on Twitter at JW on catching. That's not J1 catching, JW on catching. And visit his website, WeinsteinBaseball.com. And once again, you can follow our brands on Twitter, at @coach_AD, at Train Conditioning, at Winning Hoops, and myself at Wesley_Sykes. Our next guest is to be determined, so please take a follow us on our social media accounts for an update there. Until then, sports fans, I'm Wesley Sykes, and thank you again for listening to Sideline Sessions, and thank you, Jerry.
You bet. My pleasure.